You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, Launch Streeters. Good morning. Tamara here, your host and coffee addict. I think you'll be able to tell by the speed of this conversation that I may have been on my fourth or fifth cup of coffee. Actually, our guest today has just as much energy as I do, maybe more. But let me back up. Have you ever wondered why innovation processes seem to be so complex, almost hard to follow? I see it all the time. It's like people accidentally put in more hurdles than existed before. It just looks different. And that is why I asked Amy Radin to join us. She is a nationally recognized Fortune 100 Chief Marketing and Innovation Officer, advisor and investor, board member and thought leader on how to deliver innovation for sustainable business-changing impact. Now, note the word sustainable there, meaning not just a one-off, but long-term. Today, she shares this insider knowledge in her new book, which we're going to talk about, The Changemakers Playbook, How to Seek, Seed, and Scale Innovation in Any Company. All right, kind of like innovation, this is a high-speed interview. So let's get to it. Amy, thank you so much for joining me today. This is going to be an interesting conversation.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, so what's your first memory of being innovative?
You know, it's interesting. I grew up as one of five children. I was actually the middle of five kids born in 6.5 years. And I think from that whole childhood experience, I learned a very important aspect of being a good innovator, which is the need to be resourceful.
So you were number three.
So it goes back probably to early childhood.
So, I mean, I have to ask, was it a resourcefulness that I don't want to say you often got away with, but you really had to figure your way around because, you know, as the middle child, right, you get no attention.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I think about resourcefulness, it's figuring out how to get things done in non-obvious ways. But now that you mention it, I think one of the fun parts about me, a middle child, is that it's definitely, you're forced to cultivate skills around communications and influence. And those are two also that become really important. I think they go hand in hand with resourcefulness because the ability to get things done when you don't have obvious resources often depends upon how you build relationships with your network.
Yeah. You know, I was just reading this book the other day and it was talking about this guy was sharing a story about always being an A student. And then he got into the workforce and he was being managed by C students. And he was super frustrated. But what he realized is, and I'm not saying for all you children out there, I have two boys, I don't want them out there thinking it's okay to get Cs. But what he realized is these people who were leading him had spent all their time building communication skills by talking in class. So there's something.
Yeah. Interestingly, I think if you've always been an A student, and I was in completely non-graded high school and majors in college, so I didn't live with the burden of a GPA for most of my education. But if you're the kind of person who's always been an A student and you count on that to measure your success, you could find innovation challenging because part of being an innovator, and I was talking to a CEO founder friend of mine last week, and she says, like, I go to work every day expecting to fail.
Yeah, which is not what an A student has in mind.
It's certification system.
Yeah, no, right.
Certification system doesn't exactly nurture that.
So, no, it's a whole different podcast for us, isn't it? But I loved your definition of being resourceful about getting things done in non-obvious ways. It feels very accessible to people beyond the middle child, to, you know, all of us who are like, okay, we got to get something done. We got to be innovative. That blue sky thing is a little scary, but if I can just get this done in a different or non-obvious way, I can be innovative too. You know, your book, The Changemakers Playbook, Changemaker. I want to actually start there because I think like innovation, people use a lot of this language very loosely. What do you mean by changemaker?
What I mean when I say changemaker is somebody who's got a purpose and passion to solve an important problem, you know, to fill a need, to create something new, and they actually go ahead and make it real. You know, because ideas are easy. The change maker actually makes the change. So that was a very purposeful, a very purposeful term that I used in naming the book and thinking about how I wanted to lay out this methodology.
So it's not just the person who has all the wild and crazy forest through the trees ideas. It's really the people who then take those ideas and put something into action.
Oh yeah, it's about execution against a big vision about solving a real problem.
So here's the question I have for you, Amy. So a lot of I say a lot of us out there look at change makers, and even with your definition, and we go, well, I don't know if that's me, because, you know, I'm just an operations manager inside a company, or, you know, I'm not the R&D department. I don't get to wear the cool chief innovation officer T-shirt. Can we all be change makers in some way if we decide to be?
Well, that's a really great question, Tamara. I think that, first of all, there's probably not a lot of people out there who are the change maker, who have all the skills inside them. I see it sometimes, and I see this on a lot of teams I work with. It's a composite. And because being effective as a change maker has so much to do with collaboration, I think what's important to being effective in this role, as in any career role, is, you know, the right level of self-awareness about, okay, what am I bringing to the party and how can I contribute? And particularly in my experiences as an innovation head in the large corporate world, you really rely upon people in other areas, you know, in legal and risk management and operations. You rely upon finding those people who want to make change to get innovations implemented. They don't happen in an innovation or digital or marketing department. They happen because people around the organization want to contribute.
So you're almost spending just as much time having that purpose and passion and kind of pushing something forward as you are collaborating with other people.
Absolutely. It's seeing the vision, winning other people over it to want to sort of join the, I used to call it in one of my corporate roles, the army of the willing, you know, kind of finding the army of the willing, being an advocate for your idea and helping people see their success in what it is you're trying to accomplish. And by the way, I don't think it's much different in a startup. You know, you've got to rally a team around you to make your vision real.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I think that as you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, in a startup, we expect that. In a corporate world, we struggle with that. And that's really the I don't know if it's the advantage, but that's the benefit of being in the startup is we expect to have that change maker leader. We expect to collaborate. We expect to all be really passionate and purpose-driven in our jobs. And then somehow in corporate, we lose a little bit of that, even though that's such an important part.
I think that's right. And I think there's a lot. I mean, I for one, believe, because I've seen it, that it is possible to drive great innovation inside an existing enterprise.
Oh, yeah.
I think the challenge becomes those organizations are very focused on, you know, they're at scale. They're focused on predictability, you know, quality, repeatable results. And startups, you have the advantage of coming in and saying, well, we're here to overturn things. And so their starting point is very different. On the other hand, having worked in large organizations and startups, you have the advantage, existing companies do have the advantage of a franchise and often a great brand. And those are tough assets to build.
Yeah, very tough. I think your point, though, about it's about a starting point, not about what's possible, is really important, because they're just two different starting points. So you have to decide what you want to do with it, which I think, which is why I loved the model in your book so much, because I really appreciated the simplicity of it. And I mean that in a very complimentary way, that because I think sometimes we make innovation and the process of innovation really complicated for no reason. And I think that really hinders it. So let's talk a little bit about that. What was the impetus for the seeking, seeding, scaling model you talk about in your book?
Yeah. And I just want to make one point to build on your last comment, because I had a conversation last week with the chief marketing officer of a startup who I've been, I had a coaching relationship with her over a good part of last year. And I said, you know, tell me something. What was it that really made the difference in the work we did together? Because I always like to go back and get feedback. And she said, you know, Amy, I just think people overcomplicate this stuff. And so what you, I can't help but share that comment because she said, you know, you showed me that it is, that it's not that it's easy, but it's actually basic. It's not simplistic, but it's simple. And, you know, we're looking sometimes far beyond where we need to be to make this stuff happen. So to your question, what really motivated me to write the book was, you know, I left the corporate world. I really wanted to have a different kind of career. And as I looked around the market, I realized that my expertise and passion, which really is about not just coming up with the ideas, but doing the hard work to get them over the transom and make them real, was pretty unique and very much in demand. And a friend of mine actually suggested to me one day when I was going on and on about innovation, this and that, I said, you know, you should write a book. And I started to think about it. And I said, you know, what a great way, if I can survive writing a book, to share my expertise and really make what I know more widely available. And at a practical level, really helped me in my personal career pivot because I spend a good deal of time now working with startups and in a more advisory role versus being inside an organization. So a book, if you're able to write one, is a great way to facilitate that kind of career change.
Now, did this model, and we'll get into each phase, but the seeking, seeding, scaling, did that come over kind of the natural progression of what you realized worked? Was this about observation of, you know, thousands of others that worked? How did you get to this model?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was a little bit, it was really a synthesis. So I started out with kind of a hypothesis of here's a good way to lay it out. And then I interviewed around 50 corporate innovators, startup founders, investors, and by the way, deliberately not sort of famous people or celebrities. I wanted to talk to people who operated in the trenches and got it done and looked for commonalities and patterns and themes. So through the combination of talking to people from probably about 10 or 12 industry sectors, and from companies at all different size and stage and people in different roles, I looked for the patterns and got to the final framework. Now, I always call it a framework or a method, not a process, because process can imply linearity and innovation is anything but linear. But, you know, in a book, you've got two dimensions, so you have to lay things out on a path.
Well, and I think kind of to what you're saying, and we've seen this with the whole agile method, is people have taken it as, you know, the Bible of this is exactly this exact time, this exact, and a lot of them have failed doing that because they haven't taken it as the methodology to implement versus the process to implement. And they are two very different things.
That's right. And innovation, this makes some of my, some people cringe. Innovation is inherently messy.
Yeah, it is.
But if you start to look at it, it's got its own discipline. It's just the fact that it's iterative, the fact that failure is part of what happens. If you accept those kinds of characteristics versus fighting them, then it's not so messy. That's just the way it is.
It is the way it is. And I think what I've seen over the years is that teams that innovate well, or startups, either one, failure is part of the process, not an outcome. And I think that makes it a very different scenario and environment for innovation inside companies if you think of it differently.
That's right. And getting back to your point about startups and corporates, the starting point is different. I think the other thing is culturally, you've got different dynamics at work and, you know, the culture, just the way the place runs and the way people believe decisions should get made and things get done, that's a really big factor to determining how failure is viewed in an organization.
Well, you know, I will say, it's the last thing I'll say, and then I want to ask about the three stages. I used to do a lot of work with Procter & Gamble in their disruptive innovation team. And I remember getting super frustrated with my clients because I wanted them to pivot something, this new opportunity in the marketplace, against an existing brand. And they were pushing back and pushing back and pushing back. And I was getting so mad. And one of them finally turned to me and said, look, Tamara, this is a multi-billion dollar ship. You want me to shift the potential risk of billions of dollars for an innovation project that cost me $500,000. Like, that doesn't make sense. I was like, oh, I can totally, I mean, I don't fully agree with what they were saying, but I can understand now where they were coming from and just the different decisions and what's at risk relative to what I was dealing with.
Yeah, and I think the problem there, the risk becomes that we tend to overestimate disruption in the near term and underestimate disruption in the long term. So the people who discount the, you know, and then it doesn't happen in the near term. So we say, oh, bad idea, let's set it aside, right? And so the risk that you create is one that you can't calculate in any traditional risk model. But you've got to be out there all the time placing bets. If you're a Procter or Kraft or Citi or any big company, if you're not out there constantly placing and iterating bets, you will never have the momentum when the market is ready. And you see that today in things like conversational AI and all kinds of other new technologies that people are playing around with. By the time they get there and are at scale, if you're not in the game, you're going to miss the boat.
Well, I think that Gillette can say that about Dollar Shave Club. I mean, with those, unfortunately, they don't always pay attention until it's too late. I've got a million of those stories. But what I did appreciate about what he was saying was telling me was I needed to communicate the opportunity and the risk differently because their mindset yes. was different. And that's the part that I missed because I was coming from the entrepreneur side. So let's dig into the model because I think there's so much value in here. So talk a little bit. I've got some questions for you of each of them. So let's start with seeking. Kind of explain that to us, kind of what it is, and then I'll dig in from there.
Yeah. Well, seeking is fundamentally, you know, the starting point is finding insights by spending time listening to others. Mm. And I think really importantly, not just to what people say, but to what they do. So, you know, I give one of the examples I give in the book is how Heinz came up with the upside down ketchup bottle. It wasn't from asking people, how would you like an upside down ketchup bottle? It was from watching people struggle in their kitchens, right. getting the ketchup out and then dealing with all the goop.
Right.
So they weren't just listening, they were observing. And what I love about this example and why I included it is also a pretty simple idea, but it moved market share in a very big way and really changed the category. The other dimension that they used listening was that the idea actually originated in the shampoo industry. And so by looking beyond, right. you know, the confines of condiments and saying, well, what's happening in packaging in other places? They basically brought that into their category and obviously had a big jumpstart because the dynamics and physics of that kind of packaging already had a track record.
You know, what I think is really relevant for us launch readers listening in that story, a few things, but one in particular is it's not just about having consumers articulate their problems, but also really about, to your point, paying attention. Because I think if you had said to them, hey, we have this idea for an upside down bottle, what do you think? I think they would have said no. Like, why would I need that? I have the bottle. It's fine. I'll just turn it upside down. It's not until you really put it out there and kind of guide them to that, that the value really is proven.
Well, that's why such an important part of seeking is showing people what you mean. So putting a prototype, even if it starts out as a sketch on a piece of paper or a model built out of, you know, styrofoam or Legos, show people what you mean because, you know, people can't tell you what they would do.
Right.
Right. They can't express verbally their latent needs. But if you give them a model, you can immediately start to get feedback and then you just keep improving it.
So how do you make sure that you're not finding insights that are really yesterday's problems? I think oftentimes in research, we get trapped in this, you know, because to your point, they consumers or your customer, whoever they are, can't necessarily tell you what's going to come tomorrow. They can tell you what their experience is today and yesterday. How do you make sure you're solving problems that are or opportunities that are going to be there tomorrow? I hope I asked that right. I felt a little circular, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, I think you... The problem may not be tomorrow's, the problem can be tomorrow's problem, but it could also be the solution that you're evolving to is going to emerge over time. So I'm a big believer in, you know, again, getting back to asking and observing in qualitative insight. You know, I think we take a lot of comfort that's sometimes misplaced in, well, I went and did a big market research study, so it's statistically significant, you know, and I asked all these questions and it's very quantitative. And the benefit of being out with people who are potential users and seeing how they react to your prototype is you capture the emotion. I worked with somebody years ago on a big project in payments. And he said to me, you know, Amy, you know you're onto something when people like jump out of their chairs. So literally watching for the emotional, it's a really important signal. And you can only get that if you are with your users.
One of the things that you talked about in your book that I laughed out loud about just because I see it all the time is thinking past ourselves when it comes to seeking. Yeah. You know, we all have a problem that we need to solve, and it's obviously the most important thing in the world, and everybody is obviously needing to solve this problem. How do we make sure we're not doing that?
A big piece of that, I think, is the having a diverse core team. So I do, I'm a member of an angel investor group. And so I screen a lot of pitches from early stage startups. And when I go, one of the first things I do when I look at a pitch is I'll go to the website and I'll go to the About tab and I look at the team. And if the team, and then, you know, they'll come in and pitch. If the team is too homogeneous, I think you really putting yourself at greater risk of groupthink.
Yeah.
So the great thing about startups who are out to solve their own problem, they have incredible passion about it, right? It's their problem. The risk is if they're not collaborative, if they're not seeking diverse inputs, either from themselves or from users, from investors, just from, you know, if they don't have that intellectual curiosity about reaching beyond themselves, they could end up, you know, solving a problem that has no market beyond them and their friends. Mm.
Let's go on to seeding. So tell me about the next stage, seeding.
Seeding is really where you're proving that your rough concept is viable, you know, and I think one of the challenges is calling the timing, clearly, because I think that's a function of, you know, it's art and science, and also how much time and money you have to keep going. So I think the principle to get through seeding is to break down what you have to learn into the smallest bits that you need to figure out so you can keep iterating. You know, try to get insight from the smallest user groups possible so that you can move quickly and don't generate unnecessary expense.
Right.
So, you know, that's the idea of product market fit, right? You keep exposing your idea to users and to get that concept exactly right. But what's really helpful early on to get impact out of seeding is not just do people like the product and how they can use it, but it's also you've got a huge opportunity to understand how people's usage behavior is going to translate into what your business model is going to be. So you start to see the drivers of customer behavior that are going to influence packaging, feature functionality, and what you really need to incorporate, what your customer service model needs to be. All of that contributes to potentially cost and complexity. And the sooner you watch for that and start to figure that out, the more successful outcome you're going to have from seeding, which is not just product market fit. It's, do I have a business model that's feasible, that I can sell to investors, whether that investor is my CFO in a big company or seed funders.
So this is the stage I feel like is where you start to sweat a lot and lose sleep, because, you know, you're making pretty important decisions about your product or service. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure to at these different stage gates to yay or nay stuff moving forward. How do you make sure that you either don't kill something too soon or on the flip side, don't continue with a bad feature or full idea? Because it feels like this is the time where that happens.
You know, if I had the answer to that question, I'd be a multi-billionaire.
I mean, you can't take out the mess and the uncertainty, right? But I do see brilliant ideas get killed too soon. If they had just tweaked a couple more things, it might have killed it in the marketplace. Now, I don't have proof, but that's my guess, you know?
Right. And I've seen conversely, you know, when I worked in the banking industry, we were super, super early on mobile banking.
Too soon.
We were so early, we were doing it on flip phones, you know, green screens. And, you know, pre-iPhone, the market wasn't ready. I think the mistake, so we were too early, but then we killed the projects. I don't work out it quick.
And then you were catching up later.
And I think what you have to do, if you find you're too early, do you have the resource and kind of the stomach to keep it percolating along at, you know, I call it like the slow boil, just keep it alive because the, you know, technology may have to catch up with you, right?
Yeah.
You may not be there yet. But, and if you're too late, then you're, you know, you have to know if you're too late, stop, because you will, unless you can find a new point of difference that's going to help you surpass an incumbent. I don't believe in the notion that a fast follower is a sure shot to success.
Yeah, no, and we've seen that time and time again where that actually hasn't worked. And you know, I had a guest on the other week who was talking about don't out innovate your customer. Like, make sure that your timing is in line with them. But to your point, then the risk is you kill it too soon, and then suddenly the entire marketplace opens and you're playing catch up. It's such a fine balance at that phase.
It is a balance. I mean, I'm working with somebody now on some very early stage technology on something that truly seems to have very disruptive potential. But we have exactly this issue. And the way we're trying to sort of thread the needle is understand, okay, what is the acute pain point today that we think that the user group is
right.
telling us they have, where we can sort of, you know, where do we plant the flag? And so the vision is very large, and it seems, you know, we believe the trends will evolve to where it will have significant commercial potential, but let's go with where the user is ready today and evolve with them.
I think
it's a lot of discipline.
It does. And I'd say for LaunchTutors, that's a really, what Amy's saying here is really important, that if you're doing something wildly disruptive, totally innovative, new to the world, you still need an anchor for today to get your market on board. I firmly
right.
believe that, because, you know, I've seen, and I'm sure you have, multiple really brilliant ideas fail just because what they didn't have was the runway for the education that was needed to get people there.
Right. So it goes back to listening to your users, engaging
yeah.
them with their prototype, and looking for that intense emotional reaction. It's like, how soon can I buy this? How much is it? How much does it cost? Where do I get this? They're literally jumping out of their seats, and they're reacting to the pain point they have right now.
I love this idea of just always looking for the intense emotional reaction. I think even in my business, which is B2B, really, except for maybe the podcast, you know, I can look for that. We're all human, so I can look for that in my customers as a gauge of how close am I to getting it right. That's
Absolutely.
Really smart. Yeah.
I spent most of my corporate career in B2C,
yeah.
and when now most of my work is actually B2B, like you. And people will say sometimes, oh, it's different, it's B2B. And
it's
I'm
not.
Like, no, people in companies are still making decisions. You know, yeah, there's a business case, but there's also, how is this going to help me in my career?
Mm-hmm.
How is this going to make me look smarter in front of the boss? And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying that out of cynicism. That is, people want to feel that what they're doing in their jobs is going to make them successful. So that is part of the decision-making equation.
Yeah, it always makes me laugh when people say that to me. But we're B2B, it's different. It's still a human on the other side of that phone, pretty sure of that.
I
so,
agree with you. Yeah.
Let's talk about the third and kind of final one, scaling, which I thought was interesting because when I think of scaling, I think of, you know, going big. And you have a little bit of a different way of thinking about this.
Well, scaling, you know, it's that moment when you've got the green light to move ahead, right? So now you've gone from scrappily scrounging around to get through your beta test or prove your prototype to now you have to go out and actually acquire customers and serve them. And so you're moving, you know, a little away from the accepted messiness of those early stages to you've got to fulfill and deliver upon and respond to customer expectations and investor expectations. Somebody's giving you money, so you've made commitments. And so I think the level of precision becomes much more important. I think really understanding your metrics and what's really driving your business model and how you respond to that becomes important, you know, some level of predictability, hitting numbers. And so I think the skill sets really at this point expand and broaden. And
what?
I think a lot of founders get challenged on this. You know, sometimes the people who are great at the front end don't want to do this or are not so good or are not willing to bring those different skill sets onto the team.
Well, I think this is the hard part. If you're a founder, typically, this or the, you know, inventor side of the equation, this is a much harder place to play. It's not as easy for, I mean, this is why I have a team, because it's not easy for me either. One of the things you talk about in your book, though, is that it requires a different mindset. What do you mean by that?
To a different mindset to scale?
Yeah.
It's that you're an operator. It's that day in, day out, am I hitting the numbers? Am I serving customers? There's more, you're moving into that different kind of discipline. I don't want to say you're like a corporation now, but you're moving into that discipline where you're running something. And I think the important thing is you still have to maintain, you always want to maintain some of that adaptive and anticipatory DNA, which I talk about at the end of the book. You know, you see companies that were many examples of companies that were great innovators that fall off the rails because they go too much in the other direction.
Yeah.
They become all about delivery, predictability, sustaining quality, and they forget the need to go back to the beginning and continue to uncover unmet needs.
In your experience, what's one thing you think we are often getting wrong in each of these stages, whether that's overall or kind of one per stage, but what are we doing wrong typically?
Yeah. Well, I'd say it's seeking. It's definitely failing to uncover people's emotional needs and values. Yeah. So a lot of focus on feature functionality, not really, you know, getting to that those acute emotional needs that drive commitment to a brand, right? I think in seeding, it's very much not understanding the drivers of user behavior that connect to the key requirements of the business model. And I don't just mean financials. I mean all the aspects of operating a business. What's really, you know, what are people saying in their behavior that are translating into my potential for financial outcomes, for margins, what kind of capabilities I need to build in so I can deliver. People just don't establish that connection soon enough. And then I'd say, you know, scale, it's this transition. You know, and there's a chapter in the Changemakers playbook called the Green Light Moment, where what I advocate for is, you know, you got to kind of hit the pause button for a few minutes and say, okay, what got me here won't get me there.
Yeah.
And really understand what do you personally need to do and what does it mean for the team, the organization, your processes, you know, how you're going to operate. So I'd say for scale, it's just people fail to make that switch.
You know, Amy, what I'm intrigued by in all of this isn't just the method itself, which again, I think there's a lot of beauty in the simplicity of it in a lot of ways. And to your point, it's a method, not a process. But you keep coming back to kind of the emotion, the why, the for lack of a better way to say it, the softer things that are really critically important to the success of what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think we, you know, when we're in the business world, you know, to your point, sometimes we forget we're all people.
Yeah.
And people have, you know, deep emotional needs behind the most mundane decisions in life. And the better you are at understanding people's deep motivations and the deep problems and connecting to those, the more you are going to have loyal, valuable relationships.
You know,
I mean, if you ask people, I'm sure you've been there from your background, ask people why they own an iPhone.
Right. Yes.
People may talk now about the camera, but people will complain about the battery life. But I've heard people, you know, give like testimonials about how it makes them a better person.
Yeah.
It makes them cool. It helps them fit in. And look at the margins and the price differential and the market share.
Yeah. Well, and to your kind of point about emotional, I'll tell you, we use Basecamp. That's our big, you know, organizational project management. And when I went onto their website to check it out, what really sold me was they had this whole thing about how frustrating it is, how bogged down you feel, how overwhelmed you feel managing 1,000 emails a day. It wasn't the functionality of it, which is great, by the way. I love it. But that's not why I actually purchased it. Why I actually purchased it was I felt like, oh my God, this will help me not feel so stressed. That's what I wanted.
Right. You could feel that burden lift you up back. And I think it's, I use sometimes the phrase return on empathy. Mm. Years ago, I wrote a blog post, Return on Empathy, the New ROE. And I think, you know, empathy is more empathetic brands put themselves in a position to be more successful.
Yeah, I think that's a hugely powerful point, what you just said. And if you wouldn't mind sending me the link to that blog post, I will put it on the show notes too. Because
I'd be happy to pull it up.
Yeah, we really miss that in business. Whether we're a startup or in a corporate, we miss that empathy side quite a bit. Yet, if we think about, to your point about the iPhone, the brands and the businesses that we love to engage with, they speak to us in on an emotional level. And I think we know that intellectually, but we don't really practice it. Which is kind of funny, you know.
I think in this, you know, world of, you know, we're in such a fast and complex world where technology is overtaking our lives. I think the value of empathy and how empathy instills loyalty and how that translates into success at all levels of life, whether personal or commercial, I think it's got a little drowned out.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's kind of to what you're saying through all of this is so important. So I want to bring it back to you for a minute. You kind of more on a personal level for you. How do you innovate, do you think?
I mostly interact with people. I'm a well of ideas. I think when I'm very intellectually curious, I spend a lot of time interacting and always expanding my network. I dive into things that I'm unfamiliar with, and then I collaborate with other people. You know, this whole exercise with the book was interesting that I started out saying, well, I'm going to just do the download of my brain. And, you know, about 2 hours into that, I said, well, this is very lonely. I'm going to interview other
people. Not loving this.
Yeah, so I think that's just my inclination. I'm very curious. I dive into things I'm unfamiliar with, and I bring people together. And I think that's sort of how I contribute to innovation efforts.
You know, collaboration is interesting because I think some people are actually – that's actually – and I think I suspect you're one of those. You actually innovate through the collaboration by pulling those nuggets of information, kind of disparate pieces together out of people. We often think as collaboration as now's my chance to put into action my idea. But I think people like you, the beauty of it is and the value that you bring in innovation is actually pulling all these little pieces together to create the innovation and then putting it out into the world.
That's a really good point. It's a skill and an interest in pattern detection.
Yes, exactly.
Kind of connecting the dots. I personally really enjoy connecting the dots, and I tend to see things that aren't obvious. Now, that can get you into trouble sometimes.
Yeah.
And one thing I found in, you know, people think sometimes you're like nuts. And so that's where passion becomes important. You know, you've got to have conviction and you've got to go off and find the evidence so that people don't think you're crazy and you open up that chink of belief that you're onto something.
Do you remember Snapple, that drink?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I never forget. I was in my 20s when it first came out, and it just kept popping up. And I remember saying to my friends, I swear I wish I could invest in this product. It's going somewhere. It's just suddenly in the right places. They thought I was crazy. And then sure enough, 5 years later, it was all the rage and one of the biggest brands out there at the time. I was like, see? And they said, well, how did you know that? I was like, I don't know. I was just paying attention to what I was seeing around me.
Right. Or another great example in that category is Honest Tea,
yep.
Which I happened to have been at a presentation a couple of years ago with the founder. And really, Honest Tea does not taste that great. And their insight was around user desire for lower sugar content. And they totally disrupted the assumption of the traditional beverage industry around sugar content. But it really doesn't taste that good.
Well, that kind of goes back – it just goes to show you and goes back to what you were saying. It's not necessarily about having the best product. Like, is really iPhone the best? Maybe, maybe not. It really is about figuring out that need, that emotional need, and connecting to it in a big way. What do you think stops people from innovating?
I think certainly fear. You know, fear of failure plays a role. And also fear that comes from people just don't know how to start. Mm, yeah. There's so many people, it's like, they have a great idea and they don't know what to do. And what I tell them is like, just do something, like just start. And then to my story before about my CMO friend who I was working with last year, overcomplicating things.
Yeah. I think that's a big challenge, actually.
Yeah.
And I think, but though, in some ways, I think they're linked. I think sometimes people overcomplicate things because they don't know what to do. So in an effort to try to take out the uncertainty or to kind of not hide, but, you know, maybe layer on the lack of knowing what to do, you add layers of complication to it.
Yes, I am not a psychologist, but I think definitely
we neither all, am I, but it sounds
we,
right.
We all face moments in life where a way to not do something that makes us uncomfortable is we, you know, erect self-imposed barriers. And I think that's the other advantage of surrounding yourself with a collaborative team. I mean, I long ago gave up on the idea that I could solve all the problems I set out to solve. And one of my first instincts when I start working on something is say, who do I know who I could kick this around with?
Yeah, that's a great instinct.
Most people want to be helpful.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, I think if you come with an open mind, they're willing to give you insight and feedback.
Yes. And I actually was at a meeting yesterday where people are talking about, you know, there's a lot of training in how to give feedback. And we all need to get better at accepting feedback.
Yes. Yes, we do. So before we close, where can people go to learn more and connect?
Sure. Well, you go to my website, which is www.amyradin.com. And you can get some terrific free content there. There's an infographic of the Seek, Seed, Scale method, excerpt from my book, and also sign up for my e-newsletter. And of course, as well, follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn. My handle is Amy Radin.
Got it. What's the first step us launch readers should take if we're looking to be change makers?
Ah, be a great listener and collaborator. Get out and be with people. You know, users who you're interested in and with experts who can help you. And then I guess assume you're going to fail every day. And then last, I'd say constantly expand and care for your network, because that's the key to resourcefulness that will help you, you know, power down the road without tons of resources, especially in the early days. That's critical.
So I just want to pause and say for launch readers, one of the things, Amy, that you just said was about kind of getting out there right away. I think there's this big myth of the lone innovator that like we are in our garage doing amazing things by ourselves. And it's just not how it works. You have to get out there. So I love that that's one of your first steps.
I mean, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and I'm personally living that these days, because one of my goals for 2019 is to figure out how I can convert my content into some kind of curriculum. This week I was out, you know, chatting up with four different people with very diverse backgrounds. I already have kind of a game plan.
Yeah.
Which I would never have been able to fill out if I just didn't start talking to people.
Yeah, it's amazing what you realize by not just gathering other people's insights, but also I think that that moment where you have to articulate what you're trying to do is where you realize what you do or don't know, or what's working and not working. It's when you have to communicate it.
I think that's very critical. If you cannot explain your value proposition and your intent, you have to. It means, I mean, that you've got to be at the drawing board, but talk it through with people. Yeah. I was talking to somebody this morning as a startup, and he said, you know, every time I explain what I do, I explain it a different way. And I said, what should I do? I said, go out and interview six or eight clients who've worked with you and say, you know,
what do we do?
Where do they think you had the biggest impact on their business? And write down the words. And that's the starting point. How do people talk about you?
I love that. And I'm going to link it back to your emotional reaction. Which of what he said, which one made someone go, oh, really? Or just go, oh, okay. Because there's a difference there. I'm always looking for that reaction when I tell people.
I think it's so important, because in today's world, whether it's personal life or your professional life, we are all so busy and overwhelmed. Yeah. I tell founders, if you are not solving the first, second, or third biggest problem on somebody's list, you are not going to get their attention.
That is so true. Amy, this has been fantastic. We'll put the link to the book and everything else that you mentioned in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really been great talking to you.
Great interview. Simple process. Seek, seed, scale. Hey, fellow innovators, here's one thing I want to mention to you. Processes like these work phenomenally well if you've got your people engaged. And I want to set you up for success. So if you decide to try Amy's process, and I hope you do, I want you to first think about how to engage your people, empower them to innovate and participate in whatever process you do. We see this all the time here at LaunchStreet. In fact, what we found is that our IQE system with our assessment and tools for human innovation does just that, set you and whatever fantastic process you use up for success. I hear it all the time with clients. I'm using this process or this tool or that tool, but my people aren't doing it. It's because we got to back up and we got to get buy-in from our people. We got to get them to be innovative, to think like innovators so that they'll engage in your process. If you want to talk about it, call me and let's discuss the people side of innovation. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside LaunchStreet. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on LaunchStreet. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.